Welcome to the latest episode of the Custom Private Equity Podcast, Private Equity in the 1990s. Today we will talk with Paul Anthony Thomas, the principal at CustomPrivateEquity.com. I'm Ron Davis, experienced podcaster, and I'll ask all the newbie questions. So Paul, we're going to talk about the 90s now. What did the world look like in the 90s?
Well, the economy in the 90s started in a really deep recession. The Resolution Trust Corporation, out of all that, and the savings and loan debacle was formed, and to sell the foreclosed assets of the oil and gas business, which then affected the real estate business. So the Home Loan Bank Board went down, and the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was the mechanism that the federal government used to take over the assets and recover from the recession and depression. So it actually started in about 84 when the Continental Illinois Bank went down. That was actually the first big bank to go down. And then over another 7 or 8 years, 750 banks went down. So we had about 100 banks or so a year. In 1985, Midwest Federal went down, which was a large Minnesota bank. We had Silverado Savings go down. Sunbelt Savings in Texas was a huge fall, and that was in 91. So over the years of the early 90s, it was a pretty gruesome sight, although it created exceptional, pretty much once-in-a-lifetime opportunities for us, because since then, we've never been able to buy assets like we were able to buy assets in the 90s from the Resolution Trust. People always say you invest when there's blood running in the streets, and that's correct. You do. If you save your money until it's time, and then when the economy steps up and gives you a great opportunity like we had in the early 90s, you step up and actually take advantage of it.
What went on in the investing world in the 90s?
Well, in 1990, the Dow was trading at about 2,600. By 1999, the Dow was trading at almost 12,000, 11,500. High-speed trading became big because of the personal computers. We did a lot of personal computer work and a lot of computer work in the late 70s, mid 80s, and early 90s, and as we still do today. The 1990 $100 bill is probably worth about $200 in 2020. So that calculation has slowed greatly. As we talked about in our last episode, the government changes to the calculation of inflation have changed dramatically and slowed the calculations, really not keeping up with what we consider to be true inflation. We talked about that in our last episode quite a lot.
So what were you doing in the technology world back in the 90s?
Well, that's a very interesting thing. Netscape was actually a mid-late 90s phenomenon, and I participated in that as well, along with AOL. But I actually started my computer career in 1975 in high school. We were programming in COBOL and Fortran in our high school classes, and I went to A&M, Texas A&M, and we were learning more about COBOL and Fortran in that environment. But in the mid-1980s, after I got out of college and moved on and the personal computer started coming out, I moved into the DOS environment. And then in the 1985, we moved into the Windows environment, starting in 85 when Windows came out. And all this, whenever Windows came out, we started the C programming languages, talking about C and C++ and C++ and what we call object-oriented languages. So we were doing quite a lot of work in that. In 1986, I had a kind of a tragedy happen. My father passed away. I'd gotten to work with him for over 20 years, and he passed away. And from 86 to about 89, I had a lot of time on my hands. We were in kind of a reorganization mode. And so I spent basically literally thousands of hours learning about computers and learning about software, computer, PC softwares like Lotus 1-2-3 was the big spreadsheet of choice at that time. And it was a shame that Lotus didn't keep up with the times and that they let Microsoft take over that world. But Lotus was a great product. WordPerfect was big then out of Orem, Utah. We actually made computer training videos. The general public was having a tremendous problem with learning how to use DOS because it was a typing. The commands were typed at a C prompt and people just didn't want to sit down long enough to learn how to use it. So I made a series of videos. I ran a company called Sagebrush Productions out of Austin, and we made a video about how to program in DOS, figure out how to load up programs and what the different file extensions meant and files. And we also showed people how to do macros in Lotus in another video. And we did a DBase video, some basic programming in the DBase product, and we also did one for WordPerfect. And that we sold thousands of copies of those videos to libraries all over the U.S. Late in the 80s and early 90s, PCs began to be networked. So during that time, one of the premier networking softwares was Novell Networks. And so I became in 91, I became a Novell Network engineer. So then we studied big data management towards the end of the decade, mid part of the end of the decade, and began managing big data, 97, 98, 99. And I spent a year during the decade in night class learning how to be a certified Microsoft systems engineer and became certified to run Microsoft networks at that period, in that point in time.
And were you doing other things? What were you doing in real estate back then?
Well, during the Resolution Trust Corporation times, we did a tremendous amount in real estate. We bid on city blocks of homes in Houston. Bank of America had foreclosed on about 5,000 residential homes in Houston, and they had entire city blocks for sale. You could go in and bid on anywhere from 5 homes at a time to 1,000 homes at a time. And we put together several thousand home bids. We were going to buy these houses and flip them. We were working in the Austin area to develop mobile home parks. We could buy any piece of property we wanted in the Austin market for less than $5 a foot. Bid on commercial real estate in Austin, bid on commercial real estate in Fort Worth, Houston, Dallas, Midland, Odessa, El Paso, one building that cost $25 million to build, sold for $3 million that year. That year was 1994, I believe. So those are the kind of bargains we were looking for from the Resolution Trust Corporation. If you could build a property for $100 a square foot, we were trying to buy it for 10 or less. And there were people all around us that had a whole lot more money than we did that were doing 100 times more business with the Resolution Trust Corporation than we were doing. It was a dynamic time.
And what was going on in the energy space?
Well, we were still managing a portfolio of royalties and working interests in oil and gas leases located in 4 different states. So we had some in Canada. We were actually doing deep research into the oil and gas equipment marketplace, just like we're doing today. This opportunity has actually rolled around again for us. It's not quite as good as it was when Resolution Trust was up and running. But in 2020, in the early 2020s, oil prices have crashed so badly that the oil equipment marketplace is actually a tremendous marketplace to be placing capital into today. In last month, which this is October, in September of 2020, I could have invested $500,000 with a realistic expectation that $500,000 would become $1.2 million within 24 months. So those are the kind of returns we're looking at in that environment. We continued to buy and trade in oil royalties, and we ran pipelines during that period of time. And then one of the huge questions that came out of that period of time is, how do you place a dollar value on damage to the environment? And this is in the late 80s now, we were dealing with this, late 80s and early 90s. How do you place a dollar value on the damage to the environment done by business deals, done by oil and gas, done by real estate development, done by foundries, done by auto paint dealerships, any type of business that you want to mention that had environmental impacts? So how do you put the value of environmental damage into a t-shirt that you just bought? How do you do that? I mean, that's a tremendous problem. And in 2020, it remains a tremendous problem. So we started working on that problem back in the late 80s. And during that period of time, I needed to study how the environmental rules were made and how they were enforced. And I did quite a lot of that. I also became an expert in emergency response and cleanup of natural gas pipelines. Any kind of pipeline spill that had hydrocarbons associated with it that the EPA had anything to do with, or the state of Texas or state of Louisiana, Oklahoma, Arkansas, New Mexico, 5-state region, I had something to do with dealing with that and helping to clean those up. So.
And what was private equity like?
Well, private equity it's all driven by money. And the Resolution Trust Corporation, there are a lot of people believe that the formation of the Resolution Trust Corporation was actually the birth of what they call the modern private equity world, because Wall Street, the guys on Wall Street that were managing private pools of money made so much money during the Resolution Trust days that they had to go and start deploying that capital into other funds to do buyout, leverage buyouts and management buyouts. And it kind of solidified the entire private equity world. And the economic theories behind venture capital, and which is part of private equity, and the leverage buyout, management buyout, company buyout world, those two theories are dramatically different. And we'll talk about that a little bit later.
What were some of the, we've talked about this through all the decades, the LBOs. What were some of the more notable ones in the 1990s?
That was very funny. Late in the 1980s, Drexel went down. Drexel Burnham Lambert went bankrupt. And Rudy Giuliani, who's with the president today, was the U.S. attorney in New York. And he started an investigation of Michael Milken, who was the junk bond specialist at Drexel, and Ivan Boesky, who was one of his counterparts. And the manager of Drexel was a guy named Dennis Levine at that point in time. And they were all charged with insider trading. And finally, they got them starting to settle by trying to charge them with racketeering charges. So if they'd have charged them with racketeering, they'd have gone to jail for 20 years and there would have been no question about it. So, but actually when Dennis Levine and those guys got indicted for insider trading, the leveraged buyout market basically ceased at that point in time. So it ceased for about 15 years, 10 to 15 years, and then it came back in the mid 20 teens. And it's kind of a thriving marketplace today in the 2020s. In 1992, during the early 90s, a guy named Thomas Lee, who we talked about earlier, had a private equity fund, and he bought Snapple for several billion dollars. It was actually considered to be the first legitimate deal after the Drexel downfall. A man named Jimmy Lee was the president of the Chemical Bank, and they started syndicating portfolios, which is the early predecessor to the decline of the real estate markets in 2008. So in the mid-90s, they started the steamroller effect of syndicating loans of mortgages and other types of loans, which actually culminated in the crash in 2008. So that's kind of how this works. We call it slow money because that's how slow it works. The private equity platform is going to be profitable over a 10-year period of time. It's not going to be profitable in year one because you have to make the investment and you have what they call a J curve, where you put the money out. And then over the next 9 years, you wait for it to come back to you and make the profits and the internal rates of return that you're seeking. So we call it slow money compared to the stock market. Some of the significant buyouts in the 90s were Domino's Pizza, was bought out. Sealy, a big mattress company, Petco, a clothing company called J. Crew, that was a multi-billion dollar deal. Huge, huge platforms and huge buyouts were going on later on in the 90s. So,
right. This is the time I remember and the whole venture capital thing going on and people doing startups. You know, for me in the tech world, that was the big deal. What were some notable venture-backed deals in the 90s?
Amazon was launched, America Online, eBay, Intuit. Other venture-backed firms were called like Yahoo and Netscape, Sun Microsystems. Those were big, big deals. Telecom became a great story in the mid-90s. The telecom corridor in Dallas, the North Texas Tollway out of downtown Dallas was built during that period of time and became the telecom corridor in North Texas. That's a great way to create generational wealth, is to get out in front of a big major highway that's going in. We're doing that in Houston right now on Highway 288 that was just completed about 9 years ago. And it's the fastest growing area of the Houston Metroplex now. But we had a lot of debacles in the telecom world because there was so much money to be made by the people moving into telecom. WorldCom went down, they forged their books. Global Crossing forged their books. They were a public company that went down. A company called Windstar, they went down. All these companies that were forging their books led up to the crash of the early 2000s, which was called the tech crash. The secondary market in private equity was started during the 90s, where a bank, or an example, Bank One was in the, one of the examples. They had invested a lot of money in private equity loans, and then they turned around when private equity started going down in the late 90s. They sold those loans to a group of investors in a secondary transaction for a discount. So these other people were investors. They thought more of the investments than Bank One did, so they actually sold out. Deutsche Bank did this. UBS did it as well. So that was kind of what happened to the venture world in that period of time. The tech crash of the early 2000s really hurt those ventures. And the venture mentality, like I was talking about earlier, is different than the private equity mentality. Venture mentality is you start 10 ventures, you count on 7 of those ventures going bankrupt. That's just kind of the way it works. You count on 2 of those ventures actually breaking even on your investment. And then you're going to find 1 out of the 10 that's going to triple or quadruple your money over a 10-year period. It's totally different than the private equity model, which is find a company that's throwing off really nice revenues and go buy that company. That's the private equity model. So that's the model we kind of work in, although we do kind of a mixture of the venture private equity model. So we'll find a strategy in the marketplace today that's working real well and filling a niche. And then we'll go out and duplicate that strategy and fill more of that niche with it. So that's kind of how we do it.
You mentioned it a little earlier that the environment had started becoming a big deal in the 80s and the 90s. What types of environmental activities were you working on at that time?
Well, during the 80s, the Environmental Protection Agency was launched in 79. And so during the 80s, the Environmental Protection Agency and the environmental rules were actually being made and created and starting to be enforced. And how these environmental laws were made was kind of a quandary. People really didn't know how the EPA came up with, if it's bad for one person in a million, it's bad for the environment. That formula was actually made up by a group of guys sitting in an office in Washington, D.C., and they just said, if one person dies from this activity out of a million, then that's an issue for us. Well, if you look at the business world, that's really not very realistic. So the big question became, though, how do you mix the business world with the environment, and how do you compensate the environment for damage done by the business world? So to learn the answer to this question, I had to dig deep, become deeply involved in how environmental laws were made, learn how they were made, learn how they were enforced, learn how the environmentalists were thinking versus how the business people were thinking. So I understood a lot about how the business world thought, but I didn't really understand very much about how the environmentalists thought. So I actually went to work as a contractor for EPA, and then I actually was an employee for EPA for a number of years. But I became hazmat trained, which means I could clean up any hazardous material spill virtually of any kind. I became a national expert on hazardous waste disposal and hazardous waste management and cleanup. I became an expert over a 10-year period of time. During the 90s, I became an expert in air and water dispersion modeling, how are chemicals dispersed through the environment when they're spilled or when they're released. I became an expert in cleanup of hazardous waste spills. Asbestos became a big deal. Steve McQueen died from asbestos poisoning. It's called asbestosis. That became a big deal. That was a law that should have actually never been passed. And people that work in that law will tell you that it should have never been passed. I sat on the OSHA board that actually designed the phase 1 site assessment criteria for real estate. I became a member of the U.S.-Mexico team, where we actually worked on the city of Mexico City gets all their drinking water from groundwater, and their landfills pollute the groundwater. So they have huge problems in Mexico City. And the district of Mexico City at that time had a population of 11 million people. It's more like 21 million people today. I also worked in the Gulf of Mexico on the team that regulated pollution in the Gulf of Mexico. Worked with the National Pesticide Program. That, if you want to get into a program and a contamination program that'll scare you flat to death, study the pesticide program, because it is actually one of the worst of all. Pesticides are designed to kill, and they're indiscriminate about what they kill. And it's a very highly regulated program, but it's still a very dangerous environment. I wrote technical papers on how to calculate penalties for the federal government, how to assess damage to the environment, and how to put a dollar figure on that. That was a huge thing. I became a pretty highly trained member of the QAQC team, which is quality control and quality assessment for national chemical laboratories. I was a OSHA 600 certified, where I could go out and inspect any type of manufacturing process and do inspection on those. During the later 5 years of the decade, I was responsible for landfilling and recycling actually worked on putting together a waste management platform for the city of New Orleans. The way the city of New Orleans was actually hauling their waste 200 miles per day into Mississippi to dispose of it. So I helped try to design a system. Instead of sending 200 trucks a day to Mississippi to dispose of waste in a landfill, we were only going to send 10 trucks a day at a savings of about $50 million a month for the city of New Orleans. That was a huge deal at the time. As an investor, if you'd been a partner with us in the 90s, you would have owned a revenue interest in 10 solid waste management landfills. Huge business. The most profitable business in the environmental arena is landfilling and solid waste management. So that's an example of the types of platforms we were working on at that time.
It sounds like that you were managing a lot of people and tasks during this time. How did you do it?
Well, I was managing quite a few people at the time. I trained and studied the works of Edward Deming, which was called Total Quality Management. In that system, Edward Deming's the man who went to Japan after World War II and helped them rebuild their economy. He did it with Total Quality Management. So I became certified to help manage 2,500 EPA employees in the regional office and another 7,500 contractors. And I taught them, I was one of the 10 people in the region that taught them how to use Total Quality Management. And I also used that in my daily business. Also became a federal contracting officer, and next to my father's mentorship, working for the EPA and undergoing the training that they gave me was far and away some of the best training I could have ever had.
What types of private equity were you dealing with in the late 90s?
Well, during the late 80s, we spent a lot of time in New York City. And in New York City during the late 80s, there were city blocks in Harlem, basically, that would just burn out buildings. So we did a lot of work in Manhattan and Harlem. But from 1990 to 1993, the opportunities in Texas were so far superior to what they were in New York that we went back to Texas and left New York and started working on. I went to 20 oil and gas auctions over a 3-year period of just nothing but equipment. If you'd been a partner with us in the 1990s and that part of in 1992, 93, today you would own 20,000 barrels a day of oil and gas production. After Carolyn Hunt built the Crescent in Dallas in 1986, North Dallas and the central business district of Dallas actually boomed. So when I started working in the early 90s in Dallas, there were 500 living units in the central business district. In 1997, after I left working in Dallas, there were over 10,000 living units in the central business district of Dallas. That's the type of growth that we like to see. While I was living in Dallas, I did a lot of work along the M Streets, which is right on Central Expressway in Dallas. I did a lot of work in Uptown, which is where Carolyn Hunt built the Crescent Hotel. She bought that land for $7 a foot. Today, a lot of that land sells for $250 a foot. We did a lot of work in White Rock Lake, M Streets, an area called Greenville Avenue. I did a lot of work in West Dallas with the West Dallas Lead Cleanup Project. And I was standing in West Dallas saying, one of these days, this land's going to be worth a fortune. Right now, you can buy all of it you want for a dollar a foot. But in 20 years, it's going to be worth $100 a foot. And today, in 2020, it does sell for somewhere north of $35 to $50 a foot and on its way to $125 a foot. So if you'd been a partner with our firm during that period of time, you would own 2 million square feet of retail space and probably 200 residential properties that went up in value from $10 to $15 a square foot up to $150. Today, they sell for $250 a square foot. That property would be worth over $400 million today, and we would have probably invested less than $25 million at that point in time. So that was in the early 90s. So from the early 90s at $25 million we would expect a value today of over $400 million. That's tremendous growth, and those are the kind of growth opportunities we look for. Real estate foreclosures in Midland and Arlington and Waco and Round Rock, we bid on all those. We bid on foreclosed commercial real estate in Austin where you could buy a property for $5 a foot. We could have bought all we wanted for $5 a foot. If you'd been a partner with us in 1995, today you would own 500,000 square feet of retail office space and over 2,000 apartments in the Austin Metroplex with a value today easily of $100 million. And we would have probably invested less than $10 million in that. During that period of time, we did a lot of study in the road building business and the aggregate mining business. So if you'd been a partner with us in the 90s, we would have actually bought 10 aggregate mines that we actually did research on and got to the point of purchasing. Today, they would have a value over $1 billion and would have cost us less than $100 million. And that was in 1995 to 1997. We researched tugboat services in the Port of Houston, New Orleans, Tampa Bay. I had a friend that was in the tugboat business in Tampa Bay, and we did a tremendous amount of work there. We studied ocean shipping and actual ocean freight. We did a lot of studying of rail cars and how to lease rail cars and how to buy and make money with rail cars. And did a lot of work around the Dallas Market Center, which today is known as the American Airlines Arena area. So we could have bought any of that land we wanted to buy for $10 a foot. Today, that land sells for $200 a foot. So those are the types of growth opportunities we look for and the types of things we like to do.
You seem to continually educate yourself in private equity and just all kinds of different things. What advances in education did you make during the 90s?
Well, besides all the environmental certifications I received and became an asbestos inspector and hazmat trained and able to clean up any kind of waste problems and landfills that came across and worked with Superfund. I also spent 3 years during the early 90s studying to be a chartered financial analyst to sit for the exams. I never actually passed all three exams, so I am not a CFA, but I did study the materials and did take several of the exams. I spent 2 years studying for the CFP exam late in the 90s and the early 2000s. And then I did advanced studies in accounting at SMU. I did a lot of environmental studies at University of Texas at Arlington, North Texas University in Denton. I did quite a bit of work there, studied the environment. I was using all this education to actually try to glean a vision of what the next 25 to 30 years is going to look like. And I feel like I have a pretty good handle on that. I'm certainly not a prognosticator at all, but I have a pretty good education in history and see how things grow and see how the tech world has grown. And to this day, I continue my studies in the internet and the internet of things and the world of computers.
And what types of deals did you manage in the 90s?
Well, we started some detailed study of the assisted living world. They were not called assisted living back in the 90s. They were called nursing homes, and there wasn't really an assisted living environment. But the predecessors of assisted living today actually started back then. In the mid-2000s, I actually studied and became certified to run an assisted living facility. I became certified in the state of Texas. After the U.S. government made such a terrible presentation at Hurricane Andrew in 1992 at Homestead, Florida, I put together a business plan and a program where we could actually respond to any type of natural disaster in North America within 24 hours, which the federal government could never do, and any international disaster within 72 hours. So if you'd been a partner with us starting that business in the 90s, today you would own a share of a $1 billion a year business. So that's a tremendous opportunities in the disaster management, disaster relief world. That world has gotten a whole lot better in the last 20 years, but it's still nowhere near where it needs to be. I did deep studies into environmental law, actually working with environmental lawyers for a number of years. Alternative energies, I was the chief technical officer between EPA and the Department of Energy while I was at EPA to study solar energy, study wind energy, study cogeneration, which is where you burn waste to generate energy, And we also did a lot of study of hydropower and geothermal energy. I was on the national task force for the Department of Energy and helping Mexico and the United States work through NAFTA. I actually wrote the solid waste portion of NAFTA. That was in 92 for Clinton. In the late 80s and early 90s, I was the lead scientist to establish a company called Cardinal Laboratories, which was an environmental laboratory covering, actually serving West Texas and New Mexico. We worked in the underground storage tank remediation business and spill containment and quality control of laboratories. During the late 90s, while I was still in Dallas, I put together a business plan to build a luxury hotel connected to the Dallas Convention Center. That was a tremendous opportunity for someone. And today the Omni Hotel sits at that site. That was a $300 million project. If you'd been a partner of ours in the 90s, you would be an owner in that platform. I worked with local, national, and federal politicians and lobbying groups to negotiate new environmental rules and help write what is today known as the Industrial Waste Rules. I was on the platform that started that. I was on the E50 platform, the Environmental 50 platform for OSHA, to help write the standards of emergency response and pandemic relief back then. So we were actually working with a pandemic in South Texas called anencephalia babies. So there were a tremendous number of babies being born in South Texas with anencephalitis, which is a baby being born with an open spine. And we were doing the research to actually try to find out what was causing that. And it turned out that pesticides were causing that problem. So that was how I got involved with the pesticide program. Very interesting times.
Yeah, it sounds like it. What was your team's strong suit during the 90s?
So as I grew in financial awareness and financial studies, I generated a tremendous curiosity in what things cost and how things affect other things. So using the mosaic theory, I questioned what things cost. So today I was in a Taco Bueno, which is a Mexican fast food, Mexican place. And I questioned the manager on how much his tacos cost and how much his flour tortillas cost, and how much the pandemic had changed the cost of those items for his restaurant in the last 6 months. Fascinating conversation. So I have that type of curiosity today. I learn those things as I go. I try to figure out what the economics are behind environmental repercussions. So I'm kind of deep in climate change. I don't necessarily believe in climate change the way most young people believe in it, but I'm 60 years old, so I have much more experience than them. We do constant research. Our strong suit of the 90s was research into the environment and how things happen there. We sponsored private equity investment platforms and alternative energy. We sponsored and syndicated oil and gas platforms. We actually did a lot of work in medical devices. When I was working on the anencephalia case, I got intimately involved in hospitals and hospital waste and medical devices that reduce hospital waste and medical devices that they use in operating rooms. I did a lot of medical research during that period of time. We did tremendous research into the Texas Gulf Coast marketplace and real estate marketplace. Using my experience, my team's practices have accelerated where we could research 50 private equity deals pretty much a month now using the experience that we have. Used to, we could only do 10 a month back in the 80s. Now we can do up to 50 a month and do in-depth research into those environments. We do work in oil and gas. We do work in logistics. We do work in the entertainment field. We do work in the computer and chip making world, medical devices. We continually do research into real estate. So I have teams of people that work in these environments for me and work with me and include me in their research and educate me when new things come out. We do big data management today, which helps us a lot on our statistics and helps us get things right.
If you want more information about today's topic, go to customprivateequity.com. There are a number of resources there, as well as multiple ways to contact Paul. Again, that URL is customprivateequity.com. Any final words, Paul?
Well, as we go through the decades, Ron, our mantra changes a little bit. Today, our mantra, or in the 90s, our mantra was, if you review 100 really strong private equity deals in a year and find one or two that are really great platforms to invest in, then you've done your work and your investments will keep up with inflation and advance you beyond inflation and create cash flow and guard your wealth for you. And that's kind of where we sit, hit today. And if you do that, you hit a home run more often than you strike out.